Hello and welcome into Golf Today. Ryan Lavner alongside Golf Week senior writer Eamon Lynch. And Eamon, this is cutdown season. Last week was for the top 70, the Wyndham Championship for the FedEx Cup playoffs. This week we're trimming from 70 to 50. You can make the argument this cutdown is actually a little bit more important.
Yeah, it's amazing how cutthroat this game gets by the time you get to the first week of August. Now, every week is a different bubble. Now is the one that I think that really matters to these guys. The top 50 is seismically different to the top 70 to just make the playoffs, because these guys can actually set a schedule for next year. They make their way into all of those signature events, guaranteed starts. Those are, you know, weighted with points. They're weighted with money. It's a head start on everyone else in the professional game. If you can guarantee yourself those signature events, this is the week where you can do that.
Fully exempt in 2026 into all the signature events if you get through to the BMW Championship. And of course, if you get the Tour Championship, two-year exemption among the other perks. And certainly with the PGA Tour's regular season in the books, all eyes now turning towards the FedEx Cup playoffs. Last year, Scottie Scheffler put a bow on an incredible season with a win at Eastlake, taking home his first career FedEx Cup title. This year, rule number one seeks to become the first back-to-back winner of the FedEx Cup. And here's a look at the PGA Tour's postseason. A reminder, top 70 this week in Memphis, just a field of 69 with Roy McIlroy not playing. Cutdown continues to top 50 for the BMW. And then the winner-take-all 30-man finale at Eastlake for the Tour Championship.
And as Lav mentioned, following this week's FedEx St. Jude Championship, the top 50 players in the FedEx Cup will advance to the BMW Championship at Caves Valley. And here's a look at the players who are on that bubble. Some big names there: Jordan Spieth, Wyndham Clark, Minwoo Lee. He's the guy right there on the number at 50. Bud Cauley, one of the great comeback stories of the last couple of years, in the mix as well. And with more on what this week holds in Memphis, we say hello to Todd Lewis from TPC Southwind.
Hi there, guys. Welcome to what is normally a steamy Memphis in August. A little reprieve today. The temp's not going to get up into the 90s, but I can tell you a lot of players are going to be sweating it this week. To follow up on what you guys were talking about, yes, the major championships, the players, they're in another category. But outside those five tournaments, this may be the most important tournament on the PGA Tour schedule, because you advance to the BMW Championship, and then, of course, you get into the signature events next season. I talked to several players who are hovering around that 50 number, and they understand the importance of this week.
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is just scheduling, right? Knowing that you're in the bigger events and being able to plan. You know, this year I played well and I kind of got in a lot of those events last minute, was scrambling for flights and hotels, all those things. So it'd be great to, to get in that event and know when I'm playing in next year.
Yeah, it's huge. Changes your whole schedule, doesn't it? Even top 30, like, that's even better. That would be the cherry on top. So, yeah, that's the goal. That's what we've been playing for, yeah. So we're in the playoffs. We've got a chance. It's all you want.
It's incredible. If you're in all the elevated events, you can schedule way easier, and you can you play for a bit more points than other people. So you can, I think you can attack the year a lot easier if you're in the top 50.
You know, they are key events on the schedule, but at the same time, just because you're in them or have a spot, you know, it's not like it's guaranteed you points or anything, and you still have to go play well. They're tough events. You're playing against the guys that are playing the best as far as off the 50, and then guys that are currently playing well through the different shuffle systems of playing your way in.
Being in all the senior events is huge. You kind of feel like you get a almost like you get a head start when you're, if you're in all those, you know, there's no cuts, bigger purses, more points. And so to be able to know that you're in those to start the year, it kind of helps with your scheduling too.
Yeah, if you make it to the BMW next week and then you're in those signature events for 2026, yes, you're playing for more money in those signature events, but you're also playing for what is an equal amount of currency out here on the PGA Tour, more FedEx Cup points. And you may think, okay, if you get into signature events, you're pretty much locked in and there's not going to be a lot of turnover. Not necessarily the case. As a matter of fact, last year, 19 new players moved into the top 50 that were previously outside the top 50. That is a churn of 38%. We will see how many players move in and out of the top 50 in advance to the BMW Championship this week. But make no mistake about it, players are playing not only for this year and the FedEx Cup, but they're playing for next season as well. It is a very important week. Some players are saying that advancing to the BMW is as important, guys, as advancing to the Tour Championship, given the current setup on the PGA Tour.
Thanks, Todd. We'll check in with you a little bit later. It is a particularly important issue, this idea of the churn in this round, because I remember having a conversation a while back with Aaron Oberholzer, who played during the original World Golf Championship era. And Aaron said, once you were in those events, and a couple of good finishes was often sufficient just to keep you in that ecosystem for the next year, regardless of what you were doing outside of it, just because things were so weighted in your favour. 19 players who were in the top 50 at the end of last season failed to make the playoffs this time. To me, that is actually suggesting churn. Now, you would expect a good number to be in the top 50 because these are the elite players. But, you know, there's 29 of the top 50 from last year are still alive right now. 31 of them made the playoffs. 29 are in the top 50 this time around. That, to me, seems like a decent churn figure out here. It's not a self-perpetuating ecosystem.
I mean, that's exactly what the Tour was projecting when they first sort of rolled out this series of signature events. They wanted a 60-40 retention to churn rate with getting new players in. I mean, that was certainly the major concern when this was rolled out 2.5 years ago, that these players would just be able to accumulate so many points playing in the elevated events, they'd essentially just drop anchor and be able to run this out for the remainder of their career. You look at some of the new names that have moved into that top 50, it does feel like the right combination. You know, winners this year, whether it was a Ben Griffin or a Harris English, a J.J. Spahn, a Ryan Fox, players who have certainly improved their career trajectory. Mm. But you also have players, Eamon, who haven't won but have been, you know, consistently reliable performers. Players like a Sam Stevens, a Jacob Bridgman, a Harry Hall. Those players who have then moved out, I think, also make sense. Some of them are injured, whether it's a Sahith Theegala or Will Zalatoris, but you also have players who are slumping, a Max Homa or a Nick Dunlap. To me, it does feel like the right mix of players who have elevated and also players who have declined in 2025. And if you look at the Tour projections, this is exactly where they hope they would be.
Yeah, I think there's also the only issue that to me exists around the top 50, because I do think during the course of the season, there are enough ways to play your way in as well and play your way in for one or two events. You're not necessarily guaranteed to play your way in for the entire season. There is a lot of sort of a revolving door as the season wears on. Jake Knapp's one of those guys who played three signature events, but he missed five of them, and he's one of the better performers on the Tour. To me, it's the question that ultimately the Tour is going to have to answer here is how much of a meritocracy is this meritocracy? And that's where you get to the sponsor exemptions question with the signature events. And I've always been in favour of sponsors who are putting up the check being given a tremendous amount of latitude in terms of their ability to draw attention to the field. That shouldn't be an issue when you have the best players in the world showing up for all of these signature events. So to me, it becomes a real issue when you have sponsor exemptions going to guys who may have missed the top 50 by a mile, whereas guys who just missed it aren't necessarily as popular, don't have the stature, aren't as connected, and they're not getting the starts and the same latitude getting into these top 50 signature events as other guys do. And we've seen that over the last few years where, you know, Jordan Spieth or Adam Scott and Ricky Fowler, Webb Simpson, guys who have a great record, who are additive to any tournament, but they have gotten a lot of free passes into the most lucrative events on tour that they had not actually qualified for.
Yeah, Rex and I have talked a lot about this on the pod, and you remove sort of the name value of a Jordan Spieth or a Ricky Fowler, who certainly received their fair share of sponsor exemptions this year into signature events. Take them out of it. It's not really about who the player is. It's should those players be granted access to tournaments that are not available to everybody. Unless they do something and there's some sort of rule change where they get rid of sponsor exemptions, you're probably going to have a scenario in 2026 where this pops up again. You look at some of the notable names who are right inside that top 50 bubble. Right now, Jordan Spieth is still right there despite having access to the signature events. Minwoo Lee is certainly a popular character. Tony Finau, Ricky Fowler, these are all players who would certainly warrant attention from a tournament director in 2026 if the PGA Tour does not make the move and really make the signature events open to everyone who earns them and are not necessarily given a spot.
Yeah, this old cliche about you only eat what you kill has never really been true in professional golf, certainly not true in the signature events. Here's how you can watch coverage of the FedEx St. Jude. First round coverage beginning Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern time here on Golf Channel. Same again on Friday. Coverage begins 1 p.m. Saturday, noon on Sunday, before switching to NBC and Peacock at 3 p.m. and 2 p.m. respectively. Well, one golfer who's been getting a lot of attention lately actually walked away from the tour a few years ago. He's made a comeback as Adam Sandler's swing double in Happy Gilmore 2. Hunter Mahan takes a stroll down the red carpet to chat with us right after this.
We're pleased to be joined now by Hunter Mahan. Certainly appreciate you taking the time, Hunter. First of all, how did this opportunity even arise that you could appear in Happy Gilmore 2?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Not really sure how it totally arrived on my doorstep, but my agent, Mary Lyle Townsend from Team Wasp, called me, and she said she had this kind of, not a strange phone call, but it was an interesting opportunity, and she talked about Happy Gilmore 2, and they need some sort of, like, a swing double. They need someone else out there to sort of help with the movie, and I was like, wow, that's... it's insane. It's a crazy opportunity. I can't, I would love to do it. But the next day I was leaving for a high school golf tournament. I'm the head coach at Liberty Christian in Argyle here. So I said, I would love to be there, but I have to get these kids to this tournament. You know, I'm their coach. I've committed to doing this. So let me make some phone calls. Let me figure out what I can do and see how fast I can get there. I got there. They called me. The first call happened on Saturday. I got there Tuesday afternoon. Thanks to Liberty Christian, they were incredible. They gave me this chance and opportunity and helped me out a ton. And got there Tuesday evening. By Wednesday morning, I was putting on the makeup. I was getting the jersey on, getting the boots on, and started swinging, and it was making my impression for Adam and for the whole team to see if I could fit the bill and do exactly what they needed me to do. And then by Friday, I was given the green light, ready to go. And so that started my, journey for the next, like, 5-6 weeks.
That doesn't sound like an awful lot of time to prep, Hunter, to make your Hollywood debut as such.
Yeah, I mean, it was a whirlwind for about 4 days, that's for sure. I had, my wife knew exactly what I needed to do. And she's like, you need to start swinging right away. Get a club in your hand. And we're going to watch Happy Gilmore. We're going to see how he moves. We're going to see the steps he takes and, do the best we can with it. And so I immediately went to the backyard. We were in a rental house at the time, and I started making swings. And not the easiest thing to do. It took a little time to understand how to walk into a ball and take the club back while you're moving forward and make competent-looking swings. And then watching Adam swing, and how am I going to make this look like him, and everything else above. So it was pretty crazy, but it was clearly a once in a lifetime sort of opportunity and something that's sort of crazy, but it was so much fun. And I was so thankful for the Happy Madison team and Adam and everyone there. They really take care of every person there. And I was one of those lucky people just to be around watching really the magic happen.
You mentioned it was a 5 or 6 week process, Hunter. I mean, what did your filming schedule actually entail over that span?
Oh, I mean, I was in Jersey, and if Adam was at the golf course, then I was at the golf course. So whenever he showed up, I had to be there just kind of a little bit after him. He's not just the actor, right? He's the writer and producer and everything above. So he's working, 18, 20 hour days. But as soon as light was out, I had to be there and just sort of be there if they needed me in any sort of way on B-roll and hitting other different shots. What basically stand in, and he wanted to look at something and see how it looked, just whatever. I mean, I just was there at his leisure and was just going to do the best I can with everything, how they wanted to proceed. So I just was there whenever he was there, and it was just morning till night, basically, every day.
Hunter, it was nice to see the movie credits give a tip of the cap to Dan Baker. Dan, of course, a longtime PGA of America executive who worked as a consultant on this movie, a friend to so many of us who tragically lost his life in December in a car crash. He would have loved the reviews of this movie.
Yeah, Dan was there. I mean, he was one of the first people I met, and I recognized him immediately. What a great smile. What a great person he was. Yeah, he was helping the movie, trying to keep it. He was helping with the realism of the PGA Tour golf and professional golf. And clearly did a great job. You know, you saw him in, I think, at least one or two scenes in the movie. It's incredible to see someone almost every day for 6 weeks. Had so much fun with him. He's such an amazing guy. He gave me my first start being the AJJ, the player of the year back in 99 and playing at the Travelers Championship as an amateur. And then, you know, reading headlines in December that he tragically passed away. So, I mean, just a crazy, horrible experience. I know the Happy Madison team were devastated. He was so helpful to their whole process. So, I mean, it just shows you how fast life moves. And it's just so unfortunate of what happened to Dan. I think he was just a PGA professional golfer lifer. I mean, he loved the game. He loved everyone involved. They were more than just friends. They were his family. And, you know, really just a crazy, devastating loss for such a great man.
Hunter, seeing the filming process up close for the first time, what was the most eye-opening part to you, sort of seeing how the sausage is made?
Well, you always, you know, hear, like, what did an actor say? Like, you know, you get paid to wait. You know, acting is free, but you got to sit around and do nothing for a long time. It's just this movie, you know, it was so big and you felt the pressure of it. You felt the understanding that, you know, Adam and Happy Madison, they make their movies and they move on to the next idea. And so this has been in the works, I think, for a long time. Happy Gilmore, sort of that cult classic. And a lot of people wanted to see if it ever was going to do a sequel, this is the perfect sequel to do. And so they felt a lot of pressure to make this movie great and fun and nostalgic kind of all at the same time. They obviously took what was happening in the game of golf and wanted to tie that in. That was sort of easy for them, I think, to do. And you could tell that so many players and people, how they talk about the movie and how it sort of, how much they love it and how many people were dying to get into this movie in some way. And you saw everyone just go full out, right? From Travis Kelce to all the comedians and actors, from John Lovitz and Marcelo Hernandez and Bad Bunny and basically everyone, right? Paige Spiranics in the movie. I mean, everyone was just awesome in the movie. Charlie Hull was great. Kelce Plum. I mean, everyone was so funny. And they had their roles, and they weren't just like little snippets, right? Like they had a real role into the movie, which was so cool. And Adam really embraced all the professional golfers and everyone who wanted to be a part of it, and it made it so fun.
Does this relight a fire in you in any way, Hunter? Did you miss that kind of golf life? Is there any inspiration in you to try to get back into playing professionally since you walked away a few years ago?
Not really. I mean, it's I'm very content and very happy with what I'm doing. I trying to help these kids at Liberty Christian and sort of coach them in the best way I can. It's been really incredible for like my soul to kind of give back in a way. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, but coaching sort of found me. It sort of, and at the same time, I felt like I was pushed there. I was guided there, sort of needed a purpose. And God kind of helped me with my purpose to figure out, like, this is where we need to live. And this is where our kids need to go to school. And this is where I can make an impact and do some good and help these kids and hopefully inspire them in some way to be a better version of themselves through golf. And that's why golf is so powerful and sports is so powerful, is that you can make change in different ways. And athletes can make an impact by playing, but also by coaching afterwards, and in a very small, you feel like it's small, but you do realize the impact that you do have. So I love really doing this. I know what it takes to be a professional golfer, and it's not easy. It demands a lot out of you. And at this present moment, I just, for as much as I enjoyed hitting balls I played the other day, You know, there's something so pure about hitting a beautiful shot, right? Like just imagining it and actually doing it. That's just, it's just sort of magical in that sense. But getting back to professional golf and committing to that full time and the things you have to do, I'm just not willing to pay that price today, but you never know what the future holds.
Well, Hunter, best of luck with the upcoming high school season, and best of luck as well when those Oscar nominations come out. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate you guys. Thank you very much.
Here's Hunter Mahan and his daughter attending the premiere of Happy Gilmore. Hunter there, of course, with his body and swing double, Adam Sandler. He's gone Hollywood, folks. Well, Hunter knows a little something about playing the Ryder Cup. When we come back, Lab and I will make a couple of Ryder Cup arguments. This is going to be wrong, of course, but we'll try to play nice with him. Stay with us.
Anyway, it's time now for a little game of Tell Me I'm Wrong, Ryder Cup edition. I know this is going to be very painful for you, since you don't like to ever be told that you were wrong.
It so seldom happens.
And you never think that you are. What do you got?
I would argue here that regardless of how often they deny it, the European team is actually the favourite coming into this Ryder Cup. Because when you look at the American team, it's miles wide, but it's about a millimetre deep out there. You know, Xander's not in form. JJ Spawn's on the team on the basis of essentially one tournament. Bryson DeChambeau is kind of tough to partner with anybody. You've got Colin Morikawa in spotty form. You've got a potential of the captain being distracted by also being a playing member of the team. You've also got the potential for a lot of untested guys on the US squad right now in terms of Harris English and JJ Spawn, Russell Henley and Ben Griffin, Maverick McNealy, Cameron Young. All these guys who are in the frame have not actually experienced that Ryder Cup cauldron before. When you look at the guys on Luke Donald's team, almost every one of them, the only debate right now is which Højgaard is going to make the team. And since they both look the same, the entire team looks the same as it did 2 years ago at this point. And the whole win total thing is a bit misleading. You know, if you look at the guys in the top 15 on the American side, they have about 14 wins between them worldwide this year. You know, four of those are Scotty Scheffler's. Now, you could make the argument that
he's going to play five matches
on the European side are Rory McIlroy's, but I think the European team is deeper and more tested than the American team this year. I absolutely think. Now, it's in the European DNA to say that we're the underdogs. They want to deflect it at all times. I don't actually think it's true this year.
I think they're actually looking at recent history, because you're overlooking the most important attribute of a modern Ryder Cup, and that is home course advantage. And when you look at the average margin of victory over the last five Ryder Cups, the average margin of victory is 6.6 points. 6 points! It is as one-sided, as lopsided as you can possibly get. And you mentioned sort of the win total. It might be a little bit misleading. I think what's more important is who is winning the golf tournaments later in the season. All of those victories by players on the European team have come mid-May or prior to that.
You're also overlooking
the American team is playing better right now.
The home course advantage thing, I actually think, isn't necessarily an American advantage at Bethpage, because this isn't an audience quite like anything else. One team has demanded to be paid to show up here. Fans are paying $1,000 with fees to get in through the gate. If their team starts to underperform, the American team is going to hear it. The idea that...
But they don't underperform at home. That's the point.
No, well, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration on your part, Ryan, but what's your argument here? Let me tell you, you're wrong. What's your point?
So one of the things that you mentioned was Keegan Bradley potentially being a distraction as a playing captain. And I think right now that Keegan Bradley should focus solely on being the captain and not being a player. The reason I say that is because right now this is basically the worst case scenario for Team USA. He's not among the top six automatic qualifiers. Keep in mind, months ago, Keegan Bradley said that if he was among the top six, then that's the only way that he would play. He's actually 10th. Largely on the strength of that one victory at the Travelers Championship over your boy, Tommy Fleetwood, after the 72nd hole at the TPC. Keegan Bradley also has not done anything the following three starts following that victory. Look, if he plays well in the playoffs, hats off to him. He deserves to be on that team. But right now, I think it's in the best interest of Team USA to step aside. There are far more options to fill out the back end of his staff than there were two or three months ago when he won that tournament.
Well, there are a lot more options to... are you saying step aside as captain or step aside as a player?
Step aside as a player. I think he's well-equipped to be a captain? He's been preparing.
Well, there are just as many options to fill the captain's job as there are to fill the player's job. He's got a fairly deep bench of guys around him.
Sure, and Jim Furyk could certainly do it, particularly at home. But Keegan Bradley has owned this over the past year. He wants to be the captain. He wants to be a winning captain. But I feel like as a player, his production can be replaced by a Cam Young, a Chris Goddard, a Sam Burns, a Wyndham Clark, a Jordan Spieth. They can get points elsewhere where I think his captaincy could potentially be more impactful.
Well, I think he would probably argue that, well, he's 10th in the standings and they ain't 10th in the standings. So the idea that he's as replaceable as a player probably doesn't hold much sway.
It's also one fewer difficult phone call that he would have to make. And I think he would be potentially setting himself up for a very awkward conversation if he has to pick himself and if he does not play well at Bethpage Black.
Well, that's why the Europeans want to see Keegan Bradley on the team. I want to see that happen.
And apparently they're heavy favourites. Who knows?
Well, they certainly are. We're going to continue this conversation with the Golf Today Roundtable. We're joined now by two guys who are also often accused of being wrong. Not that it bothers them too much. GolfDigest.com contributor Shane Ryan and Brendan Porath, who's the co-host of the Shotgun Start podcast. Shane, I'm going to start with you. Let's pick up where Ryan just left it. Is Keegan Bradley going to be on this team as a player and a captain? Or just one of those roles?
Well, I thought Ryan had it exactly right. My answer to your direct question is yes, he's going to be both. But the should he question, which I think is far more interesting, is no, he shouldn't. And I just wrote a very long piece on Digest about this. I could rant at length, but to make it very, very simple, I think he has a great argument for being on the team. And if I were captain, I would put him on the team. But to pick yourself is a little strange when there's gray area, and there's a lot of gray area right now. So let's say he does that. We all know what Ryder Cup week is like. It's very long. There's no player access. We get bored. He's going to face so many questions about that every time he speaks. It's going to keep so much pressure on him. Not only him, but the person he plays with on Friday, if he plays, his whole team. Let's like speed ahead to Friday. Imagine that Friday morning he goes out and loses. And that narrative just gets juiced up beyond recognition. It becomes a really, really big story. And these things can become a distraction, which is a term that athletes and coaches love to use. And it's the thing they should always strive to avoid. And so I think this welcomes a distraction. Now, where I will disagree with Ryan is if I were Keegan Bradley, I would say, okay, let's say right now I step down from the captaincy, almost assures that you're going to get picked to play, because what a heroic move that would be. I'm putting the team ahead of myself. So you get to play now, which is your dream since, you know, 11 years, the last time you played in Glen Eagles. But also you get all the plaudits for doing that. And then you can kind of pick whenever you want a captain. You can do it in 6 years, 8 years. You can probably do it in 2 years. It is the absolute best of all worlds. And I think it's nuts that instead of doing that, he's opening the door for this potential explosive narrative to undermine him and undermine his whole team.
Brendan, two of those players potentially on that U.S. team are Patrick Cantlay and Colin Morikawa. They have been often discussed because of their sort of pedestrian form through much of the summer. How do you view their prospects? Do you view them as locks for this American team, or do you think that they actually have something to prove as the FedEx Cup playoffs get underway?
I don't think they have anything to prove, but I'm not quite sure they're locks. I think Colin Morikawa's candidacy is far more up for scrutiny at this point, even though he's higher, much farther up the points list than Patrick Cantlay. He has not played well, let's say, until really since Bay Hill and all the drama that surrounded his marching off from Bay Hill. So I think his position is under scrutiny. I think he does have a little bit of something to play for here in the last weeks. I think Patrick Cantlay can rest on his laurels, quite honestly. And he's been the best team match play player on the American side in this generation or these last several go-rounds, whether it's President's Cup or Ryder Cup, even in the cauldron of Hatgate or whatever you want to call it in Italy. He is the best player. I think that matters far more or as much as recent form. And I would expect him, you know, there's a lot of money on the line in these playoffs. We understand that can be a motivator for Patrick Cantlay. The courses suit his skill set, and I would expect him to play quite well in the coming weeks. I don't think he needs to as much as Colin Morikawa does, even though he's much farther up the points list than Cantlay.
Of course, money's also a motivator for the American guys in the Ryder Cup now as well. Brendan, sure. I want to follow on this with you. This week, a little bit of attention on the fact that Rory McIlroy sitting out the FedEx St. Jude Championship, the first of the playoffs. So only 69 of the top 70 there. Obviously, he said publicly he wasn't going to play it. Doesn't play well there, doesn't enjoy the golf course doesn't need to play there because it's not going to impact him in terms of his standings in the playoff, particularly when they've gotten rid of the staggered shot system at Eastlake. Do you see a scenario arising where the tour tries to find some mechanism to guarantee or compel players to show up for all of the playoff events?
I mean, this is just a revolving door of debates and policies, right? You know, we're going back a few years now with, are they independent contractors? Are they not? We have LIV guys now have to go play mandated their three events in the Midwest this August. I do see a scenario. I was amused by Peter Malnati, Pepe Peter, coming out this morning with that, you know, I'm the captain now meme, saying we're going to take this control back and we're going to make you, make you come play all four events, or all three events, I should say. I do see a scenario arising, not because Peter Malnati said so, but because sort of the sugar daddies and sponsors of the tour, who rightly put a lot of money and expect some return, expect some sort of guaranteed product or approximation of that product to ask for or advocate for some sort of policy. But as it is right now, Rory McIlroy, you know, the tour is bolstered by Rory McIlroy's presence, and he has the power to show up or not show up. And if he doesn't want to go to Memphis in August, well, I consider him smart for bypassing that.
Shane, if new PGA Tour CEO Brian Rolapp came to you and said, hey, how can we improve the FedEx Cup playoffs? What would you tell him?
Well, he hasn't, shockingly. I'm very disappointed. I'm wondering if he has my right number, if a digit got misplaced or something. But if he did, this is a Shane Ryan hobby horse, so buckle up. But I have always said, just play match play. They go back and forth. They have the staggered start. Now they're going back to the everybody starts at even par, which is fundamentally meaningless, right? Daniel Berger, I think, is number 30 right now. If he's still number 30 and he wins the tour championship, does anybody look at that and go, there he is, the champion of the whole year? No, it's just a random result in August, right? So the argument against match play is that, oh, the TV, you know, TV's not going to like it because there's only one match on Sunday and it, you know, you're not guaranteed to have a good match or anything like that. But one-on-one golf is the only way to determine a true champion. I mean, these are the fundamental nature of playoffs. You've got to go head-to-head. And I did devise a system that, again, I haven't gotten the call, but if you were to call me, I would say, do it so that you through the weekend, you play until there's 16 players, and then you can have four sessions of match play, Saturday morning and afternoon, Sunday morning and afternoon. And each time you can have all 16 players playing. It's just that based on the results before, on Sunday afternoon, you'll have a 15th place match and a 7th place match, and you'll have the championship match, but you'll have all 16 guys going in each session. I think it would be very, very compelling. And you would have a real champion that people cared about, which I think is the ultimate goal and a riddle that they frankly just haven't solved through all these years of format adjustments.
Brendan, that's the business end of the playoffs a couple of weeks down the road. Let's take it back to now, the start of the playoffs. Is there enough churn for you in all of this? I think we have a scenario where it's, 31 of last year's top 50 have made the playoffs again this year, which does suggest that it's probably a little more churn than the old World Golf Championship days. But is there enough of a revolving door of kicking out the guys underperforming?
I think you'd like to see a little bit more churn. It's an incredibly difficult question to answer because I think you're serving multiple purposes here. I think you absolutely want a tour that is more cutthroat, that elevates the absolute elite to the playoffs. And I think 125 in prior iterations, 100 was far too generous. And quite frankly, you know, those 30, those 55 players aren't adding a lot of value to the product if we're being cold and calculated about it. So I think the far more preferable goal to serve is creating the most elite field or the most cutthroat field for these playoffs, and as well as card-carrying members going forward. That's more for the fall series. But for the playoffs, I think that's the priority to serve. And if there is fewer or less churn, I think that can be a corollary or collateral to serving that ultimate goal of creating a better, more cutthroat playoffs.
Shane, you've covered the Wyndham Championship for a number of consecutive years, including last week in Greensboro. As a golf sicko, what's your favorite cutdown? Is it 70, 50, 30, or at the end of the year now with top 100 fully exempt members for 2026?
Yeah, I think there's always the most compelling one. And this, again, this is no longer the case at the Wyndham, but always the most compelling for me was who's going to keep their card, right? I think when the career is on the line, that's so much more interesting than, oh, he didn't get into the BMW and he might not make a signature event next year. So I like, you know, I like your fate at stake. I like the real high stakes stuff. I like people, you know, jumping for joy and crying and all that stuff. But that's what made the Wyndham so great. This year, really, the only cutoff that was interesting was the playoffs. And that was still somewhat interesting. But, you know, I think when you're kind of staring down the barrel of oh, gosh, I don't know where I'm going to be next year and I want to keep my card, that's always the more compelling story.
Brendan, just on that subject of the Wyndham, as we wrap up here, there's something that deserved some attention that happened Sunday morning. Eric Cole went out as a single early in the morning, shot even par 70 in an hour and 50 minutes. Will you here and now, in front of the American people, support a battlefield promotion directly into the playoffs for Eric Cole, for setting an example for the rest of these guys that you don't need to take 5 hours to play golf?
If anything about the last few years has taught us anything, we can make it up as we go along, right? We can add new rules, add new positions just off the drop of a hat. So, yes, that's a great suggestion. Throw him in there. Playing well, playing fast is a skill. And Eric Cole has demonstrated such at the Wyndham Championship. Get him in there. Add a spot. Rory's not there. He can be the 70th guy in Memphis.
Shane, we've spent a lot of time talking about the PGA Tour's FedEx Cup playoffs, but LIV is actually closing out its season with three consecutive domestic events that are going head-to-head against the playoffs. Is that smart or is that silly on LIV's part?
Irrelevant, because I just don't think it would matter if they were in the off week or in the good. Nobody's watching, right? I think actually, to Brendan's point, LIV should hire Eric Cole, put him out first in every event before the shotgun, and see if he can get consecutively faster. And maybe you get some people to tune in. No, I don't think it matters. Look, going against the PGA Tour will probably diminish their ratings a little bit from what they already would be, but it's not like when they go in the off weeks, it's that great either. And I don't mean to, you know, jump on them or seem like I'm trying to target them. But I think we're a couple years into this. We can definitively say that it's sort of not working, right? I mean, people aren't really watching this. And I don't think any, you know, scheduling tweaks or anything like that are going to be the big riddle to solve. It might be Eric Cole. That might be the only solution at this point.
Well, I'm sure no one's going to hop on social media later and tell you you were wrong about that take on LIV Golf right there. Shane, Brendan, it's always great to catch up with you guys.
Thanks, guys.
Welcome back into Golf Today. Eamon Lynch alongside Ryan Lavner. So it was fun looking at those aerial shots of Bandon Dunes. To me, it would be my first stop heading west out of St. Andrews to play golf. It would take me all the way to Bandon Dunes. And, of course, the original courser, David McClay Kidd, the designer who was on the show yesterday. Do you have a favorite of the courses out there?
I did a bunch of them. I've only played it once back in 2016 ahead of the NCAA championships were in Eugene. Probably Pacific Dunes was my favorite that I played at that time. I don't feel like I got the full experience. It was 70 degrees, it was perfectly sunny, and best of all, it was about 5 to 10 miles an hour, so I actually played pretty well. I've heard horror stories. I kind of want to experience that too.
Yeah, I've had some crazy wind out there. I actually once played the Solstice, which I might go back to next year. We play four rounds in one day. First ball in the air at 5:35 a.m. The last putt went down at 8:10 p.m. and the first cocktail followed 5 minutes later. Unfortunately, the day was made a lot longer because Brandel Chamblee was in the group as well.
Oh, that tends to happen with Brandel Chamblee. Do not have a PGA Tour event at Bandon Dunes. Potentially one day, that would certainly be a lot of fun. But the PGA Tour's regular season wrapped up on Sunday with the Wyndham Championship. Cameron Young finally broke through for his first career win. Prior to the victory, his 7 career runner-up finishes were the most by any player on tour without a win since 1983. Cam Young spoke with CBS Sports' Amanda Baliones after the win.
Cameron, you have been knocking on the door so often, you just ripped it off its hinges. What does it feel like to officially be a PGA Tour winner?
Yeah, it's I've been waiting for it for a while. I never thought I'd really be that emotional about it, but you know, it's the end of my fourth season, and I've had my chances, never quite like this, and I wasn't going to let it get away from me today.
With the win, Cam Young becomes the 12th first-time winner on the PGA Tour this season, and a pretty cool stat, the 1,000th unique winner on tour. And we're pleased to be joined now once again by Golf Channel insider Todd Lewis. And Todd, you had an opportunity to catch up with Cam Young earlier today. What'd you learn?
Well, I learned that he's in a great frame of mind entering the FedEx Cup playoffs. Of course, golf, as you know, Ryan, can be a maddening game, especially mentally. And Cam has experienced a lot of frustrations out here on the PGA Tour, as you talked about, a seven-time runner-up finisher on tour. But he was able to break through last week, and a lot of that is attributed to the mental approach he has now. I talked to him last week, and instead of when you hear players say, hey, I'm going to stay in the moment, not look too far ahead, Cam's doing the opposite. He is looking ahead. He's making his primary goals getting to Eastlake and being on the United States Ryder Cup team. Other things that happen in that process, like winning the Wyndham Championship last week, is just beautiful collateral. Now, after his victory at Sedgefield, he flew from Greensboro here to Memphis, and I caught up with Cam this morning, and I asked him if he's had time to take a breath and celebrate his first victory.
Not much. You know, my dad, my caddy, and I had some Uber Eats last night together, and that's about the extent of it. You know, my family's coming in tomorrow, so I think it'll be a little bit more celebratory when they get here. But yeah, I mean, this is the middle of a big stretch, and you know, there's some work to be done. So I don't really know what to do with myself other than just come out here and go back to work.
You and I were talking last week about how you set large goals, and mm-hmm. then the smaller goals will fall into place. Now, you're going on, a 3-week stretch now, you hope to be, to get into the Tour Championship. Do you treat all three of those tournaments as one?
I mean, in a sense, I think that's kind of what we all do all the time. You know, there's obviously individual moments and shots that feel different, but, you know, I think in theory we should be treating a lot of them the same. And these next few weeks, it'll just be trying to put one foot in front of the other and hit as many good shots as I can. There's, you know, I don't think there's any sense in trying to make it more important than it is. Obviously, I have some big goals that I want to accomplish, but I don't necessarily think I accomplished them by, you know, making it seem more important than it is. I think it's, like I said, putting one foot in front of the other and try to string together some good shots.
This is going to be a tough question because I know you're not a very proudful person, but if I had to ask you to sell yourself on why you should be on that United States Ryder Cup team, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few points in my favor. I've obviously had a great year putting, and that I think that's really important in those team events. From that area, I should get a good bit of support. And then, you know, that golf course I've got good memories at. So I think that, and then, you know, I've played well recently. I don't know where I was on the points list and all that a few months ago, but I feel like I've kind of made my move late and have made a push for it. So if I can continue that, I think I'll make a strong case.
Considering you had won tournaments at Bethpage, you grew up just outside New York City. If you make that team, mm-hmm. how emotionally impactful would that be for you?
Yeah, it would be really cool. I mean, that's something we circled on the calendar probably before I was out here on the PGA Tour. So, I mean, we're getting close, and obviously I've got a chance to make the team, so I'm going to do my best and try to put myself there.
And with Cameron's win at the Wyndham Championship, he jumped from 19th in the United States Ryder Cup standings to 15th, so he still has something to prove out here over the next few weeks in the FedEx Cup playoffs. But consider this. As he talked about, he grew up just outside of New York in Scarborough, New York, and his father was a longtime head professional at Sleepy Hollow Country Club, where he learned the game, Cameron did. And he's had success at Bethpage Black. As a matter of fact, when he was at Wake Forest competing collegiately, he participated in the prestigious New York State Open, part of the Met Golf Association, and became the first amateur to win that tournament. And that was played at Bethpage Black. And one other thing, guys, to consider. I want to go back to 2 years ago. Cameron Young was ninth in the U.S. Ryder Cup standings when the captain's picks came out, and he was not picked. A lot of attention, of course, went to Keegan Bradley, who was 11th in the U.S. Ryder Cup standings and was snubbed by then-captain Zach Johnson. But, of course, Keegan had a Netflix show about him. Cameron did not.
And Cameron didn't get the captaincy either. Thank you, Todd, for that update on Cameron Young. Here is Cameron working out on the range right now at TPC Southwind. FedEx Cup ranked 16th, so he's pretty much locked up his place. The Tour Championship at Eastlake, which leaves the great variable, I suppose, of the Ryder Cup position. And it was interesting, Ryan, watching him close out that victory on Sunday, because he started with a lead and he clearly decided to go out and aggressively build on that lead. He didn't look like a guy who was protecting it, made five straight birdies on the front nine. Do you think that was owed to the fact that the seven runner-up finishes, despite what we might customarily assume, didn't have a lot of scar tissue, because it wasn't as though he had faltered at the finish and lost repeatedely on tour? He was frequently outplayed by somebody who was actually having a pretty good round out there.
I think that's exactly right. He was certainly frustrated not winning on the PGA Tour over the past couple years, but there wasn't any scar tissue. It wasn't necessarily a burden that he was carrying around that he was still winless. It was more, he said on Sunday night, wondering when it was going to happen for him. So I think it's always wrong to sort of view Cam Young as like this tragic figure who has come so close so often. I think Tommy Fleetwood has had more heartbreaking losses than Cameron Young has. You look at his final round performance, Cam Young, in those seven runner-up finishes, six of which were in stroke play, scoring average under 68. And so I really do think
that gets it done most weeks.
That certainly does get it done most weeks, which is why there wasn't a whole lot of panic. It was more, when is going to be my time? I think there's certainly a sense among PGA Tour players out there that it was just a matter of time. Now, I'm curious to see if he's unlocked and unburdened in a way that he can really go after it.
Well, one thing he's certainly unburdened by is the putter, he says, and you just heard him mention that, to Todd Lewis. He was 145th on tour in putting last year. He was 158th the year before that. That's not usually something that would recommend a guy for team play, but he is up to sixth in putting on the PGA Tour this year, so he's found the confidence to back up the ball striking that has kind of always been there with this guy, and he's plenty long enough. He's 26th on tour in driving distance as well. He seems like he would be a good fit. A lot depends, I suppose, on the next few weeks if he makes his trip to Bethpage Black, because he does have to make a push at 15 in the standings. He's kind of on the outer fringes of what you would look at for a pick.
Yeah, I think that's right, but he's also trending of late, and Team USA has a deep team of statisticians and would be able to have the strokes gained numbers over a particular window of time. Had an opportunity to win in Canada, another close call, top five finish at the US Open, and then wins in the regular season finale. You mentioned the putting improvement, and there's sort of a general theme with Cameron Young now as opposed to when he was not playing his best golf earlier this season. It comes down to simplicity. Mentally, instead of wondering about when he was going to get those high finishes, more sort of relishing and enjoying the ones that he does have. When it comes to his driving and his long game, going to just one shot shape, trying to hammer the draw as opposed to sort of being artistic and carving it both ways. And the putter, though, in particular, in that massive improvement he has seen, he chalked it up simply to changing his setup with his father, you see alongside him there, David, obviously having a close relationship and intimate knowledge of his game, but also the caddy you see here there. Hired him a couple of months ago, a former teammate at Wake Forest, good player in his own right, a great green reader is Cameron Young's caddy. He's really been relying on him over the past couple of months to get it done.
In the past couple of months is when we've actually seen his form improve. I mean, a year ago he was top 30 in the official world golf ranking. He dropped as low as 66th earlier this season. Now he's back up to 21st and clearly trending in the right direction. Well, back in 2014, Cameron Young was a member of the US Junior Ryder Cup team along with several other notable players, Sam Burns, Davis Riley, Andrea Lee. The United States defeated the European team 16-8 at Blairgowrie Golf Club in Scotland. Well, the 2025 Junior Ryder Cup will take place September 23rd through 25th. Nassau Country Club in Glen Cove, New York will play host for days 1 and 2, while the singles will take place at Bethpage Black, the site of this year's Ryder Cup. Susie Whaley, PGA of America past president and master professional, will captain the US squad.
Without further ado, the grand unveiling, Eamon, of this year's Junior Ryder Cup team. First, girls Zoe Kuzak, Asterisk Tally, likely have heard of her. Many of these players who you see on this list competing this week at the U.S. Women's Amateur. And on the boys' side, some heavy hitters, including the recent U.S. Junior Amateur Champion Hamilton Coleman and Luke Colton and Miles Russell, to much ballyhooed recruits and up-and-coming prospects in the world of golf.
Well, we've never had a back-to-back winner in the FedEx Cup. This guy is trying to change that. It's kind of tough to bet against him these days. World number one, Scottie Scheffler. We dive into his odds when Golf Today returns.
And for more on the world number one, we once again say hello to Todd Lewis. Hello, T-Lou.
Yeah, hi there, Ryan. And let's say Scottie Scheffler was really busy after his latest victory at Royal Portrush. He flew to the United States and then hopped a plane to go to New York for the premiere of Happy Gilmore 2. He is a part of the cast, and hearing reviews about his performance, many are saying that he is the best actor slash player in the movie. I'm not certain that there is an Academy Award category for that. Then after the premiere, he then flew to California for some business and then back home to Dallas to decompress and enjoy what he just accomplished, winning his second major of 2025. But last week, he started practice again in Dallas, played a little golf Friday and Saturday of last week, and then came here to Memphis. Right now, he is on the back nine playing a nine-hole practice round. He was a little concerned about these greens here in Memphis because they are brand new. They might be hard and bouncy, but right now they've been fairly receptive, at least more receptive than Scottie Scheffler was anticipating. Of course, if you ask many players out here on the PGA Tour, he's already locked up the PGA Tour Player of the Year, especially if you consider that Rory McIlroy has skipped this event here in Memphis, giving himself not an opportunity to possibly make a run at Scottie by now putting only two events on his calendar with the remainder of the year. But Scheffler is going to have a lot of fun in these playoffs as he tries to win the FedEx Cup once again. He is staying this week with his good buddy, Sam Burns. Now, Sam Burns is interesting in the fact that they are close friends. They have partnered together in both the President's Cup and the Ryder Cup. Scottie Scheffler has some significant influence in regards to who Keegan Bradley picks as his captain's pick. Will Scottie Scheffler make a suggestion that his good buddy and strong putter Sam Burns should be on the team? We shall see, but Scottie Scheffler for now seems to be ready to go in the playoffs, going to take a little time off, and then excited about wearing the red, white, and blue at Bethpage Black.
Thanks, Todd. And that would raise an interesting discussion about the old boy network at the Ryder Cup, the same network that kept Keegan Bradley out 2 years ago. If the players are actually crowdsourcing their own playing partners, then why do you need a captain in the first place?
And there's something to be said for having player input, players who you either think your game matches well, golf ball, personality, whatever the case may be. But keep in mind, it wasn't Sam Burns last year in the President's Cup who teamed with Scottie Scheffler very successfully. It was Russell Henley who was paired with Scottie very successfully.
Inside that top six.
Is very much going to be on Team USA this time around, a pairing of arguably two of the strongest iron players on the PGA Tour. Worked out quite well for Jim Furyk last time. I would think we would see a repeat of that, not necessarily a Scottie Scheffler-Sam Burns duo at Bethpage Black.
As it relates to Scottie Scheffler and the playoffs, you know, the Tour has argued for years that it was a season-long race all the way to the presentation of the trophy and the check at Eastlake for the Tour Championship. That's why we ended up with a staggered scoring system, that the performance during the regular season had to have some kind of impact in the playoffs. That very seldom happens in any other sport. And there was this perception that the Tour was putting its thumb on the scale, that what happened in the playoffs was going to be determined or weighted in favour of what somebody did before they even got to the playoffs. Are you in any way disoriented by the fact that if Scottie Scheffler doesn't win the FedEx Cup, when he has clearly had the dominant season on the PGA Tour, that it is in any way a reflection of the playoff system itself? Or does that just happen in a lot of other sports where teams that necessarily just kind of backdoored their way into the playoffs suddenly find that little hot streak?
Yeah, I still don't think the PGA Tour has this right. You keep in mind with like the staggered start format, and Scottie Scheffler, if he maintained this advantage heading into Eastlake, he would have a two-shot advantage. Well, that could be gone on the very first hole if he snipe hooks his tee shot out of bounds and makes triple bogey, and all of a sudden he's no longer in the lead after winning seven times on the PGA Tour in 2024. So that never made a whole lot of sense. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense either, though. Just this winner-take-all format, an idea that a Daniel Berger at number 30 in the FedEx Cup could be crowned the season-long champion, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The PGA Tour has always struggled to shoehorn two different things together into one, having a season-long race and having a really compelling finale. It's immensely difficult to do two of those things at once. I have always sort of argued that Scottie Scheffler should already be named the FedEx Cup champion for what he did in the regular season. If you really want to make a playoffs, if you really want to make a postseason, now you should wipe the points clean. Everyone's starting at zero. You wouldn't have Rory McIlroy skipping this week. All of a sudden, you can do whatever it is you want with the format and the cutdown for the playoffs and make it this big money bonanza for something else than just the FedEx Cup.
Imagine the hot takes if Daniel Berger, number 30, was suddenly crowned the FedEx Cup champion without a win. Well, the guy who was runner-up to Scottie Scheffler in the FedEx Cup last year, Colin Morikawa, 16 starts this year, a couple of runner-up finishes, but no victories. With more on Colin Morikawa and his current state of the game, let's bring back in Todd from TPC Southwind.
Yeah, I mean, you make a great point. He did make a strong FedEx Cup playoff run last season, finishing second behind Scottie Scheffler. Actually, at Eastlake, he had the low 72-hole score. It actually counted as a win for Colin Morikawa, according to the official World Golf ranking. But because of the staggered start, he finished second behind Scottie Scheffler in the actual Tour Championships last FedEx Cup. As for this season, well, we've seen some moments of frustration for Colin Morikawa. He has been solid, but he's also gone through four caddies now, and his last two starts, missed cut. Caught up with Colin today, and I asked him to summarize his attitude heading into the FedEx Cup playoffs.
A little bit of both. I think it depends where you're at in the rankings, right? So if you are in the top five or top 10 coming into the playoffs, you can kind of look at it slightly differently. But where I'm at, where I'm sitting, you got to make sure you survive in advance. So you have to kind of chunk them up. Say, look, we're at, you know, St. Jude, FedEx St. Jude Classic, and you got to figure that out. How do you survive from 70 into 50? How do you survive from 50 into 30 and ultimately give yourself a chance to win the Tour Championship?
How would you describe mentally and emotionally this three-week stretch for you guys?
It's a grind. You know, it's been a grind. Every once we hit roughly the Players, and then that kind of rolls into the Masters, and then that rolls into the PGA, and, it kind of goes forth. It is all a grind, right? The months become very condensed. Our weeks become a lot shorter because you're putting so much time into that you want to get a little bit more out of that. But for the playoffs, it goes by very quickly. And like I said, every shot matters. It comes down to points, comes down to a half shot, a shot out there. And you just can't be willing to give out any of that because, you know, at the end of the day, you do want to make it to the end.
Colin, what do you do individually to make sure that you're mentally fresh for this grind?
Nothing special, right? We've done it before. We've played 3 weeks. We've played three hard weeks before. And I think it's just making sure you do the right things in the prep. You know, this week can be a hot week. The next 3 weeks can be very hot, humid, sweating a lot. So you just kind of step out there knowing you got to do the right steps. When you're out there, be effective with your practice. Get out, relax, reset.
I know the FedEx Cup is a major motivation, but there's another motivation next month, and that is the Ryder Cup. Do you feel like you have still something to prove these next few weeks that you should be back on that team?
Look, at the end of the day, great golf takes care of itself. And I know I haven't done that and I've made it harder on myself. But, look, I feel like I bring something to that team, hopefully, that, you know, no one else can. And at the end of the day, like I said, good golf takes care of a lot, right? So depending where I put my focus, obviously a huge, huge goal is to make that team. I want to be there. I want to be representing the red, white, and blue. I've done it in the past. And like I said, there's no other feeling like it. There really isn't, right? Stepping on that first tee wearing your colors. So I've got some work to do. But it's proving to myself that I know I'm the golfer that I know I can be. So I'm getting back to that. Game's feeling a little bit better, and hopefully we can put it together for 3 weeks.
Thanks, Colin. Wish you the best.
All right, thanks, Todd.
Yeah, a calm but hungry attitude for Colin Morikawa as he enters the FedEx Cup playoffs. And as you can tell there, he is thinking about the Ryder Cup. Yes, his main focus is playing well each and every tournament in this playoff system, but it is also making sure that he can ensure himself a spot on that U.S. Ryder Cup team. I would say a couple of months ago, it was just about a certainty that he was going to be on that team, given his ball striking. He's currently eighth in the standings, but those two missed cuts in big tournaments, including that Royal Portrush Open, has maybe put a little bit of doubt. It's likely he's going to be on that team, but it is not an absolute. He's going to have to still prove something over the next few weeks.
FedEx Cup playoffs, Ryder Cup talk. Certainly love this time of year. Tilu, appreciate the insight. Look forward to talking to you on Wednesday.
You got it.
All right, guys. What do you think here, Eamon? This is a player who, I think, as Tilu mentioned, would have been a lock earlier this season. Had a really strong spring. Statistics have been very good. Skidding of late. Would Keegan Bradley possibly leave off a player of Colin Morikawa's ilk who is currently scuffing a little bit?
it would be a heck of a choice if Keegan picked himself over the guy ranked number six in the world. And in a way, that's the problem Keegan faces right now, is that the more guys who play well put themselves into the conversation without being in that top six, Cameron Young being a prime example of that. You've got a guy like JT, a proven team player as well. Patrick Cantlay, arguably the best player in Rome a couple of years ago for the Americans. And then obviously Morikawa at number six in the official World Golf Rankings. All of those guys have a lot of stature. They have a lot on that CV and resume to put themselves in the mix for a Ryder Cup pick. It makes it all the more difficult for Keegan to make a decision. Even if he's playing well, even if he's totally justifiable as a pick himself, it makes that decision a lot more loaded. It makes the blowback much more predictable and inevitable on that, particularly if he doesn't deliver inside the ropes at Bethpage Black. And I think that just adds to the potential pressure on him that week. Again, as a European, I wouldn't necessarily object to seeing that happen. But Morikawa is an intriguing case here because, you know, he's only had four top 10 finishes this year. He's normally good for twice that in the last few seasons. He hasn't won in a couple of years. It is grating on him a little bit. We saw his little tete-a-tete with the media after he declined to speak after losing that Sunday at Bay Hill, the Arnold Palmer Invitational. I don't think it's a knock on him at all. I mean, you're number six in the world without having won much in the last few years. He's won basically one tournament in the last 4 years since the Open Championship. That, to me, is testament to the kind of consistency that Colin Morikawa brings to this tournament. At Bethpage Black, not going to be the longest guy in the world. He's not necessarily the strongest guy in the greens, although he's certainly made some progress on that. But there aren't many guys out there who hit it closer going into those greens.
Yeah, that was certainly a point of emphasis, particularly for Colin Morikawa, who really struggled at Royal Portrush in the Open Championship, just hitting iron after iron after iron in the tournament practice area, trying to get that part of his game dialed, because he's one of the most accurate players on the PGA Tour. We all know that. But if his proximity to the hole is not as sharp as it has historically been in his career, he's really just going to struggle. He's a very streaky putter, as he has been for the majority of his career. I always chuckle at the idea that we have to crown these guys now, or we have to pick these guys now. There's a reason, Eamon, that they don't make these picks until after the Tour Championship. That's three more weeks of high pressure, big tournaments against the very best players on the PGA Tour. There was this rush to put Keegan on the team after the Travelers Championship in June. There was a rush to put Chris Goddrup on the team after what he did across the pond. We still have time for Colin Morikawa. If I'm Keegan Bradley and I'm sort of diagnosing and sort of identifying potential players I would want to have on my team, I'm putting faith in Colin Morikawa finding something over the next month and a half, because you don't want to be playing your best right now. You're trying to project and forecast who's going to be playing the best in a month and a half's time at Bethpage Black. And I still think Colin Morikawa's skill set can be very complementary to some of the other players on the U.S. team.
So you're arguing that Colin Morikawa's skill set is not sort of outweighed by Cameron Young having won the New York State Open at Bethpage Black 8 years ago?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Although I do think Cameron Young should be on that U.S. Ryder Cup team as well.
Well, we do have a certain recency bias in this game these days.
So we certainly do. All right, stay with us. The 125th U.S. Women's Amateur is underway at Bandon Dunes. When we come back, we're talking to our friend Amanda Blumenhurst, who knows a thing or two about hoisting the Robert Cox Trophy. And Amanda Blumenhurst joins us now. Amanda, it's great to see you. When you think back to 2006 in that Curtis Cup, what did you know about Bandon Dunes at that time, and what were sort of your initial impressions of the golf course?
Well, we were so fortunate to get to play it a bunch in preparation. So we walked the golf course over and over again. It is honestly my favorite golf course stateside. Old course of St. Andrews still takes it for me, but Bandon Dunes is a very close second. The scenery, gorgeous. I love this type of golf course. It's also an awesome match play golf course, which is what I loved in the Curtis Cup.
Is there an adjustment period for this kind of golf for these players on a week like this, Amanda? Because most of the time they're playing golf through the air. Here they're kind of playing the ground game is much more important. Do you think there's a significant adjustment that these players are going to have to make?
You know, these players are all so good that they've practiced, but it will be an adjustment. It reminds me a lot of playing overseas, and that's probably why I really liked it. I loved having that Texas wedge, hit it, keep it really, really low, using a putter kind of almost anywhere. I like that style of golf, but it also is extremely windy, so that is going to be a huge adjustment, and it's also one of the parts, you know, it's physically demanding playing at the U.S. Amateur, U.S. Juniors, anything that's stroke play and then match play is taxing mentally, physically, but then also with this wind, having to battle that element is going to be for sure an element.
On yesterday's show, we had David McClay-Kidd, who, of course, designed Bandon Dunes, and he said he expects that the women will put on a masterclass in course management, that the guys in the amateur back in 2020 just wanted to play the ball through the air with a lot of spin, so they ended up with pars winning a lot of holes out there. And he thinks that the women will use the contours a lot more to their advantage. Is that what you'd expect to see as this week wears on as well?
Oh, I totally do. When these, I say women, girls, some are so young, but are learning great course management from a really early age. And because just don't hit it as far as the men, they're having to be more strategic out there. They're having to kind of think through it. They can't just crush it off the tee and then try to fly a 3-wood to get to the green in 2. Some of the holes, they will be able to do that and play a little bit higher risk, higher reward, but it will be strategic out there. And it's going to be really, really fun for the viewer to watch as well and see what kind of strategy these players use, especially in match play.
Amanda, a few years after that Curtis Cup, you won your own U.S. Women's Amateur. Looking back, what did that title mean to you at that point in your career?
At the moment, everything. I had finished runner-up the year before at Kyrgyzstan and was absolutely gutted, devastated. It was in front of my family and friends, who are all from Indiana. And so to come back and win the following year, it was redemption a little bit, but it just made that win even sweeter. And it's so difficult to win U.S. Amateurs, U.S. Juniors, because of just the format and how grueling it is. And having to play so, what feels like almost perfect, but you also have to get a little lucky too. You have to maybe not play against somebody who's just playing their A-plus game as well. So it's a little bit of all the elements, and being able to go out and win after that runner-up finish the year before made it so sweet. And I still, I mean, even with you, with the Golf Channel, I get introduced as U.S. Amateur Champion, even, you know, 20 years later. And so it is very important to me and to all the players out there going out. They know that's on the line.
The last back-to-back winner we had of the U.S. Women's Amateur, Amanda, was Danielle Kang. That was back in 2010, 2011. Rianne Malixi is trying to join that list this week. She played very well in the first round. She tied for the lead in the stroke play qualification process. Just how high a mountain is it for her to climb to actually win this back-to-back again?
Well, just kind of what I said, it's so difficult because you have to also get a little lucky. But also for her, you know, having had those injuries last year, early this year, took her out of the Augusta National Women's Amateur, and she was one of the favorites out there. I'm glad that she's playing healthy, that she is in the top of the leaderboard. She's one of my favorites, though, to win. It's not just because she's a Duke Blue Devil. I mean, I definitely will give her a little added points for that. But she is an incredible player. It is a long road, though.
Amanda, with the rise in stature for tournaments like the Augusta National Women's Amateur or the NCAA Championships, where do you think now that the U.S. Women's Amateur sort of fits in the hierarchy of marquee events for women's golf?
I mean, probably I'm a little biased, but I would say it's number one, for sure. I'll say that. Until the cows come home. Augusta National Women's Amateur, though, wasn't around, you know, when we were playing, and I really wish it was. It's definitely getting up there. NCAAs, now that it's televised, now that it's a match play event, now that these collegiate players are so good, it's also climbing in importance and stature for that individual win. But still, got to give it to the U.S. Amateur.
Well, Amanda, I know you'll be watching when our coverage begins on Golf Channel on Wednesday. Appreciate this trip down memory lane. Talk to you down the road.
Anytime.